So we watched this movie the other day, A Man for All Seasons. It's a great movie. 1966 or so, I think it was.
Yes, it won Best Picture in 1966.
It won Best Picture in 1966.
Yes.
Okay. It won a couple of awards. Paul Scofield played the part of Saint, well, posthumously. I guess they're all posthumous saints, but later on he was venerated as saint, but in his lifetime he's Sir Thomas More. And then Robert Shaw plays the part of King Henry VIII, and Orson Welles, I think, knocks it out of the park as Cardinal Wolsey.
Wolsey. I don't think he
Wolsey.
was he a cardinal?
He was a cardinal. He actually had a non-canonical marriage, because at the time the Catholic Church in England, there was no Anglican Church at the time, but they were still a little bit iffy about the whole celibate priesthood. So some of them had wives, and he had two children from what seems like his lawful marriage to his wife. So kind of interesting, a non-canonical marriage. So, anyway, I was reflecting with you later on, and since we watched it last week, regarding some of the great themes in this movie. There are themes of not just, kind of unum contra mundum, which is a popular Hollywood theme, no matter what the topic is, one man standing against the world and making a difference and all this stuff. Okay, that's fine. But you could also be one evil man standing against a good kingdom, right? And that would still sell in Hollywood because it's so perverted. But more to the point, this is one man, Sir Thomas More. We don't really need to give away the story. If you're a student of history, obviously you know how this all goes down. But one man standing, one lawful, law-abiding man, full of true justice and impartiality, standing against not only a king and his insatiable lust and covetousness, but also against the court of men who surround the king. Whom the king has surrounded himself with, who, as much as the king, or maybe even more than the king, vituperate Sir Thomas More and everything from heckle him to condemn him into submission. And yet, Sir Thomas More doesn't submit at all. I'm not necessarily interested in reflecting on the movie, the movie's historicity and, how true to the facts it is, it was, was it more fact, was it more fiction? I think that's a fine discussion on its own. What I want to do is just simply extrapolate what I think are some important lessons regarding criteria for totalitarianism. How do you know you're living in a totalitarian time? And by totalitarian, I don't mean, well, let me just say what I mean. I mean the kind of regime rule that where the state seeks to basically become God or has in some measure arrogated onto itself semblances, approximations of God's attributes. The state wants to be omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent. There's a surveillance state of some sort, which in our day we associate with the internet, but it hasn't always been that way. And things like that. So I think there are three things, and you tell me what your thoughts are.
Do you
Go
want
ahead.
to summarize the plot?
Not really.
Okay.
Look it up. Go watch it. Go read some history before you watch it.
So three things.
Well, maybe it's helpful now that I think about it. Do you mind summarizing the plot for us?
Sure. So, King Henry VIII has been married for many years to Catherine of Aragon, who was his late brother's widow.
Who I realized was a king. He had ascended to the throne. He'd been king for about 5 months or so.
Okay.
And we're talking about early 1500s. So just as the Reformation
Right.
is underway
Yes, just as the
in that
Reformation is
milieu
underway.
of great change.
Right. So he has no living, King Henry VIII has no living male heirs. He is restless and decides that the only way to get male heirs and to gain new happiness in his life is to change his woman, as one of the characters described it. And
It's a charitable read. He wants male heirs. Maybe he's just this lusty stallion, but
sure.
whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, so he aims to divorce Catherine, and he already has the next woman picked out. But you have to have the Pope's annulment in order to dissolve a marriage. The Pope had actually given him a special permission to marry his brother's widow because you weren't supposed to do that either. And so the Pope is now not going to give him an annulment of this marriage. So King Henry VIII determines that the best thing to do is to declare that somebody far, far away in Rome should not have authority over the people of England, the rulers of England. He names himself what's the title that he gives himself?
Well, he's the supreme head of the church.
Right. So he names
The
himself.
Pope, oddly enough, when he had written a work against Martin Luther in 1521, the Pope had honored him and bestowed upon him the title of Defender of the Faith.
Right. But now King Henry VIII declared himself the head of the church in England, which basically separated, split the church and moved the Church of England away from the Roman Church, which wasn't really the purpose. The purpose was just for him to have authority to do what he wanted to do.
Basically.
And then
Well,
he.
go ahead, and now I might have to pick up here because I think this is the segue in.
Right. So I'm trying to remember exactly what the document is that he has written up. The document he has written up, and he wants everybody to sign.
The Oath of Succession.
Yes. And what is that? That affirms himself as the head of the church.
You tell me.
Affirms. I'm just trying to
Summarize.
remember the details. The it
Sure.
affirms
It's an
his
oath.
marriage with Anne, and affirms that her sons would be heir to the throne. Her son
Right.
would be heir to the throne.
Right. Not illegitimate.
Right, would not be illegitimate, but legitimate. So he wants everybody to sign that, and pretty much everybody does because they don't want to get in the way of the king. But Sir Thomas More refuses to sign. But he also refuses to state why. He determines to remain silent on that fact so that, in order to protect himself
Let me pick it up from there.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, good summary, I think. I think one sign of totalitarianism is seen precisely in not only the striking of the oath, the writing of the oath by the king and his henchmen, the foreman of which is Thomas Cromwell, and portrayed very ably by that actor who portrays him, which I don't remember his name, whoever he was. You cannot disagree with power. You have to get in line. You have to do it. Everyone's doing it. And so there's no principled disagreement allowed, right? That's a sign that the screws are tightening, that the walls are closing in, and that the place you thought was free is actually a prison cell. Because there is no dissenting voice. You must think, and you can only think, in accepted conventional ways. Whatever is deemed acceptable and conventional by whoever's in power, all right? I think that's one criteria of totalitarianism you see that you can get from the movie, that you can start seeing parallels throughout history, not just in Tudor's England, the House of Tudor, right, King Henry VIII, but you could see it in other places, right? So, right, we're taking this movie as a launch pad and jumping from here to looking at other things. Related to that is that because there's no dissenting voice, truth is unacceptable. Sir Thomas More, as he's portrayed in the movie, my interest is in the lands and the history and the kind of Middle Earth that's created in the film. Again, the historicity is here and there. All right, that's not my interest here, but in the movie, the portrayal of Sir Thomas More is one that is honorable. He's an honorable man. He's a family man. He's committed to truth. Not the king's truth, true truth, right? I was just hearing a podcast from a friend who puts out a podcast talking about science and how you have in many places true science, which follows logos, which follows the order of the world, the divine design, the reason, and the way God ordered his creation. And then you have pseudoscience. And in the Soviet Union, you had a kind of thing called Soviet science. So whatever my net don't catch ain't fish, you know, if you know what I mean. And I think in a place like Tudor's England, you have truth. You have the king's truth. And what that means is that things now in the world get conscripted to serve political purposes, ideological purposes. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that divorce is wrong in England in 1527. That doesn't matter. What matters is that the king seeks an annulment from his wife. That's what matters. And so we better line up with the king's ideology. And no dissenting voices are allowed, including the voice of truth, which is ably represented in the movie by Sir Thomas More. When you do that to power, when you do that to the state, when you do that to government, and government isn't the only power in the world. You have other governing authorities. The king doesn't like it. In this case, King Henry VIII doesn't like it because he has surrounded himself with his court prophets, right? It's like in the historical books when, you know, Jehoshaphat and Ahab are, you know, aligning themselves for political purposes, right? And Jehoshaphat just, you know, he wants to be on the safe side. He's a king of Judah, so he has the fear of the Lord. He's a son of David. He has a fear of the Lord. He says, okay, Ahab, I realize we're going to go on this military expedition, you and me and our armies together. I just want to make sure this is kosher. I want to make sure the Lord's going to bless this. Do you have any prophets around here? And Ahab says, yeah, I got a bunch of prophets over here. And they're on his salary, right? They're salaried prophets. They're on his dime, right? He pays for them. And so he says, he trots them out, the court prophets, yes men. Yes, King Ahab, you will succeed. You will be triumphant. You will come back in a number of days, you know, riding the chariots of victory. And Jehoshaphat, because he's a son of David, you know, he's a little skeptical about the whole thing. And he says, you have any other prophets here? So Ahab says, I have another prophet, but he never prophesies what I want. And it's Micah, no relation to the prophet who writes the book of Micah. And so Micah comes out and says, okay, you know, they take him out of prison. And the jailer says, listen, you're going to get trotted out here and, you know, try to be a team player here and say what the king wants. So Micah gives a deep sigh and he comes out, and Ahab in all his splendor and his flesh, you know, is somewhat hesitant, but he allows Micah to speak. Micah says, oh king, you will be victorious. He yawns. You're gonna do a great job, right? And Ahab says, you see, you're always lying. Micah says, you want to know the truth? You want to know the truth? Okay. You're not going to come back. You're going to die. And your house will come to an end. That's the truth. And so Ahab cares nothing for truth. King Henry VIII cares nothing for truth. Because why do you need truth when you have court prophets who tell you what you want to hear? But the Jehoshaphats of the world don't really care for yes men. The Jehoshaphats of the world want truth, no matter where it leads, and no matter who's involved, and no matter who dies, they want truth. And so with King Henry VIII, you see that everyone's trying to appease him. I forget the character's name, but is it Norfolk? His friend?
Howard, Duke of Norfolk?
Yeah, Howard, yeah. So he's almost executed, right? The addendum at the end of the movie says, except that the king died. Was that him?
Yes, I think that's right.
Yeah.
The king died the day before.
The day before, right. So did he die of syphilis? Was that it?
Yes.
Yeah, you know, no. He didn't have a lust problem or anything. Just syphilis, you know. It's like the flu.
Yeah.
It's like COVID.
Just caught it somewhere.
He caught it somewhere. It was an invisible enemy. So even Howard, his friend, who is not principled, goes along with the flow. Right? And when the mob is raging, that's really a hard time to grow a backbone and to find principles somewhere. And I think that's a lesson for us as God's people. Grow in the grace and knowledge of Christ. That way, when you're in the middle of the storm, you don't lose your sight. You don't lose your path to port, to safety, right? You know where you're going. You know what this is all about, right? But in the middle of the mob, Howard loses everything and ends up being, right, what was he, he wasn't the prosecutor, that was Cromwell, but he was on the prosecution's team.
Yeah, I don't, I think he was still Duke.
Right.
But I don't know what his position in that particular case was.
Right. Well, yeah. Contrast that with Sir Thomas More, who stands firm, almost a Martin Luther figure, right? And you have to understand that, you know, this movie isn't pro-Catholic. It's not necessarily pro-Catholic. It's not necessarily pro-Protestant either. And to say that King Henry VIII was this stellar Protestant reformer, I think is stretching history a little bit, you know, a tad bit too much. I think the portrayal of King Henry VIII was magnificent. Just a very plausible loon. I mean, right?
Right.
This guy is just crazy. But here's the point, though, I want to get to, which is that in a totalitarian regime, not only do you have, or in a totalitarian environment, right? Because no one ever presents himself with horns and a pitchfork and a tail and says, "I'm the devil." So, right, the pot is boiling by the time you figure things out, right? So, in the currents of totalitarianism, right, in the totalitarian environment, in the atmosphere, in the air we breathe, in the water we drink, dissenting voices are not allowed. Everything gets pushed and subsumed under power and the ideologies of power, such that you can't speak the truth without being penalized. And the point is this, that tyrants cannot coexist with goodness. So pluralism is a myth, and coexistence, peaceful coexistence, is a myth. And I think my generation, we grew up, and prior generations, of course, we all grew up with America's a diverse place, multiculturalism, diversity's good. Look, we're a pluralistic nation. Whew, thank God we're not a Christian nation, right? Thank God we're not pure like those Puritans. And I mean, who wants to live in Calvin's Geneva? You know, it's horrible. We're pluralistic, right? That's a great thing. You know, separation of church and state and all that jazz. Not realizing that that's only one stop in this train line. That's a means to an end. You're pluralistic in order to eventually become totalitarian. That whole thing about being diverse was meant to dislodge the nation and dislodge a people from a Christian foundation, its Christian moorings, however distorted and soiled and tainted it may have been, right? Jim Crow, slavery, abuses that existed, undoubtedly, because we are in a fallen world, and yet Christian, right? You could see it and say, oh, that's Christian, right? And you look at Saudi Arabia and say, oh, no, that's Muslim. And you look at communist China or communist Russia and say, oh, no, that's atheistic, right? And irreligious, which is itself a religion. So you could look at America and say, oh, Christian, right? But the whole pluralism trap dislodges us from Christianity because diversity is good. Why would you want to be a Christian nation? That's tribalistic and primitive and backward. But you see, when you have this movement away from a Christian foundation, you don't stop moving. You keep moving. And what's on the other side is a singularity that rules your nation. It's not Christ. It's not the gospel, it's not Christendom, it's tyranny, right? And so, King Henry VIII cannot abide Sir Thomas More. And in that particular scene, when the king kind of crashes his house, Sir Thomas More's manor, and they have to kind of have an impromptu meal. They kind of knew about it in advance, but it looks like he's crashing in. He has three mid-sized boats with all of his court jesters and prophets and his yes men and the people who are going to soothe him, soothsayers, as it were. And then everyone goes in except Thomas and Henry. They stay outside. In that striking scene, King Henry VIII says to Thomas, "Thomas, I have all the men. I have the political men. I have the wise men, and so on and so forth. But Thomas, I need the honest men. And you're one of them." And that, I think, is at the heart of a totalitarian atmosphere. Before it cements and calcifies, when it's still wet, and when it's still wet cement and hardening, a totalitarian atmosphere says that. It seeks the corruption of goodness. "I have all these wives, but I want your wife. There are all these pools of water that I've put my paws in, except yours. Yours is still clean, it's still pristine, it's still virgin," right? And I think that's something to note, that in a totalitarian atmosphere, it's not good enough that you're a Christian, and you're religious, and you're a good neighbor, and an excellent worker, which you should be all those things. And you have a certain goodness about you. You're not ironic. You don't live an ironic, sarcastic, mockery-filled life. You're not a mocker, right? That's not good enough. You need to join. You need to join the regime. You need to believe what's believed. You need to follow where we're all going. And you need to get in line. I think that's one of the most important lessons, I think, from this movie, is that evil seeks the corruption of goodness. Coexistence couldn't exist in King Henry's England. Pluralism was a farce. Everything had to serve the interests of the king. And I think that's a lesson for us to take away from all of this.